From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we're focused on leadership in the time of crisis. We're taping this on April 10th, around week four, since much of the country has shut down. And today we have two truly exceptional leaders. Dan Akerson has a distinguished career as a naval officer. He was CEO of several companies. He was a private equity executive. Most importantly for this podcast, he was chairman and CEO of General Motors during the financial crisis when that company faced historic challenges. Admiral James Stavridis is truly a modern-day Renaissance man. He's a four-star admiral. He was Supreme Allied Commander. He has a PhD and has written 9 books. And he carries this unique distinction. It's truly unique. He was vetted for senior roles by both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in the last election cycle. Thanks so much for being here and welcome to Transition Lab. Let me start with just seeing how you're doing personally. Dan, we spoke earlier this week and you were in the middle of a walkie-talkie conversation with your 5-year-old grandson. How's that going?
Well, it's a reasonably wide diversity of activities. One, I'm speaking to my 5-year-old grandson on a walkie-talkie. He was out in the backyard. And two, I was speaking to you. So that speaks volumes about the diversity of activities this past week.
And Jim, you're in Florida?
I am. And we chose, Dave, to come to Florida and kind of ride the storm out because our 85-year-old parents are down here. So it's been a good experience. I'm doing about 80 to 85% of what I normally do, obviously doing it on video and telephones, but continuing my work with the Carlyle Group, doing a lot of media, doing various corporate boards, and generally staying in touch. I'm also working on a number of national level initiatives to try and deal with coronavirus.
Well, it's great to hear you're doing well. My biggest challenge at my house is that my kids really want a social distance from me, but otherwise we're doing well. Let's go to the focus of this podcast, which is leadership, preparation, and effectiveness in government. Dan, let me ask you a question that gets to the essence of who Dan Akerson is. I've known you for many years, and one of the things that struck me is that you always told me that your service in the military, your service to the public, was more important, more relevant, more valuable for you than being CEO of GM or being CEO of another big company. Isn't being CEO of GM a bigger accomplishment, a bigger deal than being a lieutenant in the Navy?
Well, I think it's kind of part and parcel of who I am. My dad actually graduated in high school in 1940 and quickly enlisted in the Navy, fought entirely from day one through World War II. Korea. He was a tremendous role model for me. And when I graduated in high school in the mid-60s, it wasn't a question of whether you were going to serve. Following in his steps, I went to the Naval Academy. And it was a combination of both A, need, be candid, and B, you were expected to serve in your country. And you can't help but be imbued with a sense of duty coming out of Annapolis. And I certainly believed in that. And I'm proud to say I served for 5 years. Met my wife during that period of time. Her father and grandfather were both Annapolis graduates, distinguished people in and of themselves. So we have a lot of naval tradition. And unlike the admiral, I didn't serve for 30-plus years.
And Admiral, how did you end up going to the Navy? And did you anticipate serving for 30 years when you decided to go to the Naval Academy?
I felt as though it was kind of the family business for me. I grew up in a Marine Corps family. My dad finished up as a colonel of Marines, and I always wanted to be in the military. I will admit, when I first went to the Naval Academy, I was thinking I wanted to be an infantry officer in the Marine Corps like my father, but after going out to sea on a midshipman training cruise, it was like being St. Paul on the road to Damascus. I just knew I wanted to be a sailor, and so I shifted my sights from the Marine Corps to the Navy and kind of never looked back. It's been a, a wonderful 37 years in the Navy.
Our topic today is leadership at a time of crisis. And you both have the unique distinction of serving in both the military and in the private sector at senior levels. Could you spend a minute on the different leadership skills that are required in the private sector versus the military? Admiral?
I guess you could say Dan and I are kind of bookends on this one, Dave. Dan obviously had the Naval Academy and an initial set of tours in the military and then a very long career in business. I had that very long military career, and now I've been in the business world for some years after being the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University for about 5 years in the middle. I guess what I've found that transferred quite seamlessly are two very basic things that are the same. And one is a sense of integrity and the need for honesty. And at the Naval Academy, we have an honor code. We don't lie, cheat, or steal. I think that's a pretty basic framework, kind of the minimum standards, if you will. But I think leaders know that they have to have that bedrock of integrity, whether they're in the military, in the business world, or for that matter, in the world of higher education that I inhabited for 5 years. I think a second thing that transferred pretty well is the ability to communicate, the ability to take an idea and inspire others about it. And that's both a technical skill, the ability to think and speak and present well, and it's also a kind of creative skill as you take an idea that your team has come up with, but then you have to move it across a very wide frame. I think that's been a very significant similarity. And then thirdly, I suppose, I found both in the military and in the business world that innovation is critical. Steve Jobs, who knew a lot about innovation, obviously, and if you haven't read Walter Isaacson's marvelous biography of him, do so. But he said that the difference between leaders and followers is the ability to innovate. And I think that's true. And that was true for me in the military when I changed the command structure of U.S. Southern Command to make it more responsive to the challenges in this world to the South in Latin America and the Caribbean. It was important in Afghanistan where we tried to create programs to do literacy training, for example, for Afghan soldiers and police officers. You've got to be able to innovate in the military. And now in the business world, particularly working at the Carlyle Group, I see the companies that rise are the ones that are willing to innovate. I see the leaders, the CEOs who are innovators are the ones that we're hungry to find so we can collectively move that company to the next level. So I guess those are three things that I think transfer pretty seamlessly for me, that sense of integrity, that ability to communicate, and that sense of innovation.
Let's focus on leadership in the midst of coronavirus. Let me get your perspective on leaders in your view who are distinguishing themselves today. Besides Tony Fauci, you're not allowed to say him because that's too obvious. Who's someone in the government that is distinguishing themselves today with respect to their leadership?
I think what we're seeing is a very strong performance by and large of the nation's governors. And let me keep it strictly bipartisan here. And in fact, I'm someone who was vetted for vice president by Hillary Clinton and was offered a cabinet post by Donald Trump. I kind of think of that as two bullets whizzing by my head at times. But I'm very bipartisan. And as I look at the spread of governors across the country and what they're doing for their individual states, I'm pretty impressed. One who's impressed me a great deal is Governor Cuomo up in New York with his level of energy, his, I think, quite extensive communications skills, his organizational ability, his innovation as he goes after these problems. But he's a Democrat. However, I lived in Massachusetts for 5 years and got to know Governor Charlie Baker up there, who's not super well known, but he's a Republican, wait for it, who is the governor in one of the most strongly Democratic states in the country. He knows how to build teams. He knows how to reach across the aisle. At the governor's gathering a couple of years ago, he got the highest ratings of any of the governors from his peers. So I think for Governor Baker, I think he's shown us a lot in terms of building teams, collaboration, working together, reaching across the aisle. I think those are two pretty strong performances, but you can look all across the country. And by the way, I want to close on this by saying it's a tough job to be a governor and to have a federal system above you that has to be catered to so that you can get the help you need. But at the same time, there are political cross currents embedded in that. And there's dispute about who has what kind of authority. And the governor is kind of the individual in the middle between the federal government and the people. And that's a tough place to be. And not all of them are making every decision right. But I think collectively, we should be pretty proud of the nation's governors.
And Dan, on the business side, are there any business leaders that are distinguishing themselves today?
It's hard to comment on the business side without making some sort of at least glancing deferment, if you will, to the politics. So, and I know General Motors was initially kind of put in an odd position, but quite frankly, as it sorted out, General Motors came out as very constructive and helpful. But let me go back. In times of crisis, you don't want someone to kind of bemoan the unfairness of life and how did we get to this situation. We're in it. And what I like in times of crisis, and I've seen companies go through them, been in the middle of it, what you want is someone who's constructive, doesn't try to continually reflect back into how did I get into this situation, but how do I get out of it? And I agree with the Admiral. I think Governor Cuomo, and it's his empathy. It's his specific knowledge. It's his guarded optimism with a vision of how do we get through this and preparing people, not trying to sugarcoat it. It's going to get worse before it gets better. It's not destructive. It's constructive. And he outlines, how is he going to go about it? And he does it on a routine basis. And there's no politics. I mean, I'm sure it's back in the background, but the average consumer of his presentation is reaffirmed, and I think he's done a terrific job.
How does the scale and scope of this crisis compare to previous crises that you've been involved in or read about?
Sure. First of all, yes, General Motors was a great challenge and one that of that era was probably one of the biggest corporate challenges. Lives were impacted. Economics were impacted for not only on an individual, but on a corporate and on a national scale. But lives were not at stake as they are today. So it's hard to make that comparison. But if you stand back and you look at it, anytime there's a transition, if you will, there's what I'll call industry, national, individual disequilibrium. There's change. And change is always hard to adapt to, even the smallest in a family, a relationship between you and your children, you and your spouse. But on a corporate level, in the case of General Motors, which had been an over 75-year basis, I think they were number one in the Fortune 500 for 50-odd years, and to see it crash and burn like it did, first you have to come in and you got to analyze what went wrong. In things of that scale, a company with $160 billion in sales that crashed to $125-$130 in a reasonably short period of time had multiple issues that had to be addressed. So when you come into something like that, as we are on a national scale now, first you have to analyze the situation. Where am I? What's gone wrong? How do I get out of it? And I would say, you have to have not only a vision, you have to have a pretty good understanding of what has gone wrong.
Jim, how do you compare the size and scope of this crisis compared to previous crises you've been involved in or read about?
Let me start by saying this is the biggest crisis the nation has faced since the Second World War. And that's going back 70, 80 years. And I think the only way I can categorize it from relatively recent life events, say part of this 21st century, is to say it kind of combines the worst of the financial crisis with 9/11. And in that sense, it is obviously a dagger pointed at the heart of the U.S. economy and the global economy. That's what the 2008-2009 Great Recession was. And I think that as I look at things unfolding, I think there's a 10% chance we could see a global depression come out of this. I don't predict that. I think there's probably a 60% chance we have a reasonable bounce back, probably another 30% chance it's a longer time to recovery. But that threat to the global economy from 08-09 is now combined with the sense of uncertainty that came out of 9/11. And, you know, we tend to always rewrite history in our mind and think, oh yeah, we knew all along that we would destroy Al-Qaeda, would eventually find and kill Osama bin Laden. Hey, in 9/11, newsflash, we didn't know any of that. We grounded the entire global airline system, just parked every airplane on the ground. We had no idea what was coming next. And I think this crisis has elements of that in the uncertainty that it faces. Now, here's the good news. In both of those crises, one of the fundamental keys eventually became global cooperation, working with other nations, international cooperation. Second key, interagency cooperation, the organs of our government pulling together to accomplish a great deal. And thirdly, private-public cooperation was necessary in all those. And I think that that's really the prescription for dealing with the coronavirus crisis. And if we put it in that sort of context, we know this is the biggest challenge we have faced, again, I believe, since the Second World War, but the solution to it, international, interagency, private-public, is right there in front of us.
Well, given that, what do you think the proper role of the U.S. military is, and is the military doing enough?
The U.S. military has a significant role. It's necessary, but not sufficient to solve the problem. The U.S. military has 1.2 million young men and women, all volunteers, on active duty, who are relatively healthy, quite fit, predisposed to serve others. Another 800,000 in the reserves. That's 2 million people. Now, they have a day job, and that day job is defending the country and forward deploying and conducting military operations and training and maintaining their equipment. But there's a lot of capacity in that Department of Defense. We've seen the edges of it commendably with the deployment of Comfort, the deployment of the field hospitals, the deployment of Mercy out on the West Coast, the two hospital ships. There is a great deal more the military can do in terms of logistics, medical treatments, military manpower and support to the governors via the National Guard programs, budget. There's an enormous level of resources that can be devoted. And I'll close on this point, Dave, by saying, collectively, we need to be thinking not just about COVID-19 and novel coronavirus. We need to be getting ready for the next pandemic so we don't have these kind of missteps. So the military could have potentially very significant role there in things like creating national stockpiles. We need 500 million N95 masks. We need tens of thousands of ventilators. We need them inventoried, accessible, ready to go at a moment's notice. I think that's going to be one of the crucial lessons out of this, for example. A military can do that. We have bases all over the country. We have a national and international distribution system. That's but one example. So bottom line, the military can help a great deal in this crisis. It can help prepare for the next crisis, but it is only part of the international interagency and indeed the private-public effort that has to be put forth in both of those categories.
So let me drill down on that a little with you, Admiral, because there's clearly tension between two competing goals. One goal is the health and safety of the sailors in these very small quarters on ships, destroyers, and submarines. And the other is the need for the military, the Navy, to be ready to have their ships at sea. So how do you reconcile those goals?
A pretty good example of the kind of tension our military will face is the episode of the USS Theodore Roosevelt, the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier that was pulled offline when hundreds, I think now roughly 700 out of the crew of 4,000 or so have tested positive for coronavirus. That's 15% of the crew. Already one of those sailors has died, tragically. The military has a role to play in forward deploying, conducting operations, but at the same time, it has to take care of the health of the force, the sailors in the case of the Navy, the airmen, the Marines, the Army soldiers. We have to care for that force, not only because it's the right thing to do, but pragmatically because our national security rests on it. So the military is going to have a tricky passage finding the balance between taking care of the military but continuing these vital forward deployments. We're going to learn a lot as a result of what unfolds from the Roosevelt, and I think we'll be able to apply that to other U.S. military units as this crisis continues.
So, Admiral, maybe you can share with the audience the approach or strategy you've taken with communications in times of crisis.
A good example of using militaries in this kind of crisis was the work facing the U.S. military after the earthquakes and the outbreak of cholera in Haiti about a decade ago, as well as the U.S. military's work fighting Ebola in Western Africa, with which I was not as personally involved. In both cases, the critical communication element, first of all, proceeds from the inside out. And what I mean by that is the team inside the organization, inside that military unit, has to be aligned with the mission. Next level out, the U.S. interagency. During the Haiti crisis, I worked extensively, for example, with the administrator of USAID, Dr. Raj Shaw. Together, we worked with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. These were efforts that brought that next level of communication across the interagency. And then thirdly, you communicate with your allies, partners, and friends. And we had terrific allies in working with us from Latin America. The Brazilians, the Chileans, the Argentinians all had contingents there working very impressively on this. Once you get that international interagency piece together, then you're ready to go out and communicate to the people of Haiti. And here you have to do it in a way that understands their culture, their history, their language. The first time I went to Haiti, I thought my French, I speak French well, and I thought that would be sufficient to move around Haiti. Of course, it's not. They do not speak routinely French. They speak a language called Creole, which is an amalgam of a variety of different dialects from all around the Caribbean, from Africa, and includes a fair amount of French as well. So it's an example of how you have to speak the language of the country, understand its culture and history, and you can only do all that effectively after you achieve that internal alignment, again, proceeding from the inside out.
We're in the midst of a presidential election. There could be a second Trump term, or there could be a new president. Dan, what would you advise the Biden team to be thinking about now in terms of how to prepare for taking over the government?
Let me take two steps back. The first thing you have to do is you got to be truthful. You've got to give a realistic, broad-based appraisal of the situation. Let people know that you understand how complex the problem is and that you don't have all the answers, but you're always going to tell the truth, the absolute truth. You're not going to bend it for political perception or gain. And by doing so, you'll have authenticity. If President Trump were to lose, if I were a new administration coming in, I would make sure the president should come in and make sure he's picking the very best people. These are not political appointees. These aren't paybacks for supporting me, but people that really understand what leadership is all about, whether in government, in the military, or in business, and build a team that have a bias to action, not reckless gambles, but measured risk and reward, and take the smart track down the road.
Last question for you. One of the aspects that's been totally underreported in this crisis is the issue of mental health. People are hurting all over the country. They're dealing with crises, financial crises, family crises, health crises. Jim, you've been in wars. How did you deal with the issue of mental health in those crises, both at a macro level and when you're dealing with people on a one-on-one basis?
I think every military commander can remember the first time he or she loses somebody in a combat situation. For me, that was Desert Shield, Desert Storm. A young engineer on my ship died tragically in a combat situation. And it felt to me as the captain of the ship to not only communicate directly and immediately with his parents, he was unmarried, he was only 19 years old, but to follow up with them. And when we came back from that combat deployment, I flew and met with them and spent time with them. And this is something every president has to do. Every chairman of the Joint Chiefs who goes to Dover and sees those young men and women come back to their final resting place has the burden, the privilege as well, of speaking to those survivors and trying to give them comfort. And words are never going to be perfect in a scenario like that, but you reach into your heart and you speak from your heart to theirs. And I think that is all we can do and all we can offer in those moments. Part of this also, Dave, is understanding the kind of strains and stresses and invisible wounds that so many of our veterans experience, and understanding that requires that same deep sense of empathy. I think in many ways, the most vital quality of a leader is the ability to put himself or herself into the shoes of the other. And that's important in any number of different ways, but particularly when we are leading those who are vulnerable, who are under stress, or survivors of those who have fallen for the nation. And that quality of empathy is something you gain over time with life and experience. And it is something I have worked hard to improve in myself. And it is something I commend to every leader as well.
Dan, would you like to add anything to the Admiral's comments and any advice you have for whomever wins the next election?
Yeah, when I went to General Motors, people were panicked. Their retirements were threatened. Their well-being, the retiree population was, what's going to happen to me? Our retirement is, pools are underfunded by more than $10 billion. We were able to restore those during my tenure. But you have to over-communicate, and you have to show that empathy, that you care, that you have a plan that's going to reconcile. There were suicides, quite frankly, that weren't as, didn't have the, for the benefit of the nation that Jim was just talking about. The new chief executive, whether it be Biden or President Trump, I think you can put down the sword and the shield and say, look, not only do we have to cure this medical problem, this life and death problem, we have to reconstruct our economy, and we're going to have to rebuild it. And I can't just be singularly focused over here. I'm going to have dual efforts. And I've got to get the very best from the military, from industry, from medicine. And I've got to manage this across a broad spectrum of risk and reward decisions that are going to be made. I can't just focus on one thing. And I've got to do it for the better good. And so don't tell me about, well, you're going to have an adverse effect on the real estate industry if you do this or if you do. I've got to do what's best overall for the broadest swath of the American public. I think that the next president, whether incumbent or new to the job, they're going to have a tough job. But America's always been resilient. I've got a lot of confidence in the quality and the character of the American public. I'm confident we'll do it. But I think we've got to stop this bickering from the far left and the far right and do what's best for America. Put America first, better than your state, your company. We've got to be one. That's what it's all about.
Well said. Let me thank both of you for your time today. And most importantly, thank you for your service to our country. Just a reminder that we invite guests with many different political views on Transition Lab. The views they express are theirs and not the partnership's. If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.